Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Hey everyone, it's Michelle Williams, and I love being able to share my story with you on my podcast, Checking In with Michelle Williams, where my guests and I, we get real as we share the ups and downs of our mental health journeys, and I'd love for you to join me. Hey, it's going to be your church and your turn up. So listen to Checking In with Michelle Williams every Tuesday, a part of the Black Effect on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Takecast. My name is Davis Matic. You guys can find me on Twitter, at Davis Matic. In this episode of the show, I am joined by the current host of the World Poker Tour, Tony Dunst. You guys know I love to talk about poker on the show, and not really sure there's anyone better to talk about poker with right now than Tony Dunst. He's a longtime online grinder, has played professionally, still plays professionally, is getting in on all the action online. So we have a pretty wide-ranging conversation about Tony's career in poker, how he came to end up hosting the WPT, of course, the Polk D-Negs match, and much more. I think you guys will really enjoy this conversation. If you want to get more episodes of the show, you can subscribe on patreon.com/takecast, or if you just want to support the show without spending any money, you can leave a rating or review on iTunes, Google Play, wherever you listen to podcasts. That's very useful and helpful. And now let's go ahead and get into the show. All right, everyone, welcoming in Tony Dunst from the World Poker Tour. Very excited to have him on the show. I actually, it's very indulgent of me. My favorite shows to do on this podcast are the poker shows. So super excited to have Tony on the show. And, you know, my favorite question to ask people with gambling in general is just like, you know, everyone has their, this is how I found, you know, being a degenerate, and this is why I love it story. So what is the Tony Dunst poker origin story?
My origin story is I had four or five different jobs in high school, and you know, some of them were good, some of them were bad, but you know, most of it added up to about $5.50, $6 an hour to have some manager on a power trip push you around. And around that time, poker started appearing in television and picking up pace online. And when I found that and started playing with my friends, I did a little bit of math and realized I was making more money per hour, having fun, screwing around with my friends, playing in like $5 and $10 poker games than I was at any of the jobs that I'd had in high school. And I was like, okay, clearly I've been approaching this wrong. I just need to be a card player.
Yeah, which is a good, right? Especially when it's making money, like especially consistent money, because, you know, many, many origin stories are like, oh, you know, I binked this one tournament, or like the Haralambos Vulgaris one where he like leveraged it all on the Lakers. And it was like, you know, if the Lakers don't win that series, we never hear for all of Bob. So it's like, it's always interesting when it's a little bit more iterative, like, oh, I did this thing and I was really good at it for a long time, which I guess maybe is not that uncommon in poker, since the games pre-Black Friday were, I barely played then. I was a teenager then, but even like I could beat the Full Tilt games in like 2009. So it's just, it was a very different world. Like poker now is hard, dude. Like playing 1-2 online, like you'll just get crushed. It's so hard.
That's exactly right. Poker has evolved to a very tough place, especially for new players jumping in at lower stakes, trying to work their way in. It's not, like you said, pre-Black Friday. I got started in like 2002, 2003. I mean, people barely knew the rules back then. You know, like poker books at Barnes & Noble were, you know, selling like fire because everybody just wanted to know the rules. Now, like you said, if you jump into a 1-2 game online, you're going to be up against a decent amount of professional poker players who have spent months or years practicing their craft.
Yeah, like a person playing 1-2 on like Party Poker or whatever in 2005 would have maybe read like Phil Hellmuth's book or something, but now, right, Like a person playing 1-2 in like a legal place in the States, like probably has a solver on their computer. They're like 50-50 to have a solver. It's just like, it's insane how much more difficult it is, which I really fell out of poker from, you know, like about 2010. Like I still played a little bit after Black Friday, from Black Friday till quarantine. And then, you know, I was a part of the masses to flock back to online poker because I haven't left my house in 6 months. And, It is very mind-bending to see how different the game is now, comparatively speaking.
Yeah, and you know, it is my hope, of course, that we see online poker, real money online poker, legalized in more states because there is so much pent-up demand. And we see that, you know, in a lot of different forms, America as a country has come around to gambling. It is no longer this scary form of vice that we have to stop people from having any access to. And it would be so much better if people were allowed to gamble against each other in a game of skill where the best ones actually will be rewarded with being a profitable player over time, as opposed to only having, say, you know, house edge games and sports betting with high vigorish available to them where almost everyone's going to turn out a loser over the long term.
Yeah, I mean, the vig thing is huge. Like, this is something like lawmaker doesn't understand the concept of like 5% rake versus 15% rake, and it's like why we've seen like in the District of Columbia in Washington D.C. like they have legalized sports betting there, but the vig on it, they're like, it's like 50-cent lines because the operators there, they just don't even get it. So like the legalized operators there get no business and are failing, and I'm sure the lawmakers who helped pass that are like, well, why did we even do this if no one's using it? And it's just like they don't understand.
Yeah, I just don't even know who I want to yell at first in that chain of command. You know, the politicians or the casino execs charging 50 cents on the line. Come on.
Yeah. So this is actually a nice little natural transition because I was doing a little bit of research for our show, and it appears you've lived in like a billion different places. You've lived in Australia. You've spent some time in Asian countries. And so first off is, what was your favorite place to live? But then more importantly, what are the best gambling cities to live in?
My favorite place to live was Melbourne, Australia, which overlaps with your second question because Crown Casino, which is one of the nicest casinos in the world, is located in the heart of Melbourne. And it's a huge complex like the Las Vegas casinos where it's not only the casino floor, but you know, restaurants, clubs, bars, shops, things like that. So beautiful property in an awesome city with a great gambling culture around it. Gambling is a lot more mundane in a lot of ways in Australia. The idea of having like a punter shop where you can go and place your sports bet has been around for a very long time. Australians on the whole have a great sense of gamble to them because their entire origin as a country was this enormous gamble to like travel some infinitely far away island and try and make it for yourself. So Australia's up there, but you know, I've been fortunate. There's a lot of places that if I could go back there, I'd happily spend another 6 months, year, whatever it is.
Yeah. And I have not done like a tremendous amount of traveling or anything, which bums me out because you're right. You know, the average response to like, oh, like, you know, I work in fantasy sports for a living, and people hear that and they're like, well, that's not a real job. That's like, that's stupid. Right. And I'm sure you get some of that too, when you're like, oh yeah, I'm a professional poker player, or actually you probably even hear it more when you tell people, oh, I commentate on pro poker for a living, and they're like, what, that's a job, or people are interested in that? Like, it's just so bizarre that Americans, like, gambling is the best, it's so fun, it makes no sense that we don't like it here considering how indulgent of a country America is.
I also happen to think that gambling is legal in many forms, we just don't call it gambling, like whether it's the insurance you take on your car, house, health insurance, whether it's the investments you make in the stock market, whether it's, you know, taking out a loan on a home. There's all kinds of gambling that we engage in every single day, but you do it in a casino and all of a sudden everyone gets kind of Puritan about it. And it's a really dumb double standard to me. But I also understand that there are precautions or concerns about problem gambling in the way that, you know, casino gambling can lead to those issues. But still, I feel like America on the whole has a double standard when it comes to gambling and would do better, as many countries do, to just to conflate the two.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of the things about our country that just does not make a whole lot of sense. And I would credit this as being like a Nassim Taleb idea, but it's probably larger than that. But just like in general, the Western mind is so bad at probabilities and at understanding risk. So yeah, yeah. You're right. Like insurance is a risk. Driving in your car is a risk. These are all calculated risks, but we just are not processing things that way for, you know, I don't know, a million different reasons really. Yeah. All right. So there are many things that appeal to people, obviously, about playing poker, gambling, daily fantasy sports for, you know, professionally or at least as a hobby. What was the thing that you loved the most? Was it being your own boss, like controlling your own destiny? I mean, and it does take a special type of person, obviously, to be basically unemployed, you know, untethered to a monthly check.
It's the autonomy and, you know, more specifically, the lack of an alarm clock. Just the idea that if I don't feel like doing something, if I don't feel like waking up, if I don't feel good enough to play or do my job today, then I'm not going to do it. And I really can't put a price on that autonomy. You know, technically, I gave it up taking a job with the World Poker Tour, but it's one that merged with my lifestyle as a poker player so well. It was like, you know, a bit of an adjustment becoming a professional and having to respond to people's emails in a timely fashion, kind of thing. But on the whole, what really appealed to me about poker and gambling and, you know, daily fantasy sports, all of it for a living, is the autonomy, the idea that people can't tell you what kind of person you're supposed to be, how you're supposed to act, when you're supposed to be there. Oh, that wasn't a polite thing to say. Like, all of it. The idea that basically you are, it's a full-blown meritocracy. So your ability to survive, make a living at this, is based on your abilities, your skill, the work you put in, and not at all your social connections, the way you present yourself, the way you network, all the stuff that I tend to cringe at.
So what was your, I guess, pre-Black Friday game like? Were you playing a lot of no limit ring games? Were you one of the sit and go grinders who like was 36 tabling with your pre-flop push fold charts? Like what was your online journey like?
I was up to an 18 table multi-table tournament player, and I would say pre-Black Friday I was never more than a so-so reg. I think that in those years you could get by making money without really pushing yourself to improve your game, and we spoke about that a little at the top, and that I, like many players, younger players, was complacent to just, you know, make a decent living, not having anybody tell me what to do. Okay, log on, play some games, you know, whatever, don't take it too seriously. So, you know, I would just play a lot of tables. I wouldn't necessarily think as hard about my decisions back then as I would now. Now I play like, you know, four tables max and prefer a little bit less than that if I can. And like I said, you know, was definitely a average player at the time who could make a living, but tended to run on autopilot.
Yeah, I think that was pretty common, right? Because the games were a little bit easier then, but also in terms of, if I understand things correctly, you know, in terms of studying is just much more involved now in a way that, you know, 2005, 2006, like you would have had to have not only like dedicated the time to study, but you would have had to like develop your own programs, like code them from scratch, which not a lot of people were doing. So you would not gain as much by not doing that. I'm kind of wondering, you know, when did you start hearing about, like, you know, Phil Galfond work, you know, creating solvers and a lot of those guys? Like, do you remember the first time you booted up a solver or even like heard of the idea?
I've still never run a solver because it's just work that I outsource via, you know, training sites or other people doing the work. I study the outputs of solvers and use software that has had solver outputs built into it very, very regularly. As far as when I first became conscious to solvers, it was probably sometime in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years where I started to hear about them more regularly. And I'm in a network of guys who are at the peak of the game. And so I would hear them talking about it, or they would be studying poker more seriously. But it wasn't until the last 2 years that I was really ready to make that same kind of investment in the game and the study myself. But yeah, you know, people are always a little surprised when they hear from someone who plays seriously now that, like, I don't I don't run a solver myself. I don't know how to run a solver. I'm sure I could. I'm just so lazy about learning that kind of stuff. And I just think that, like, man, if I can pay you to do the part of the work that I hate the most and then mm-hmm. just study the results, I would much rather do that than try to learn how to, like, run this program. Maybe that's dumb and lazy, but whatever. We all got our learning methods.
So what are the games that you are mostly playing now? Are you playing cash games? Are you still focusing on the tournaments? Because I guess, again, from the outside, you know, I think it would be easier to get by not trying to play super GTO in tournaments than it would in cash games. Like, you can still play more exploitably in tournaments, and that can be a profitable strategy, especially, you know, in the GTO bros hate this. But, like, I've always sort of believed with poker that, like, there, some people are just naturally better at it, that they have an intuitive better sense, like someone like Doyle Brunson, right? Like, there's just something that enables Doyle's brain to just be really, really good at all forms of poker that is not necessarily explainable outside of, like, you know, natural talent.
You know, on that note, Solvers and Doyle and everything, he tweeted recently that way back in the day, he and one of his gambling peers literally, like, dealt out hundreds or thousands of hands and kind of, like, counted the outcomes and tried to come up with some rudimentary sense of what the odds were. So there was always mm-hmm. a curiosity from those guys to try and evolve the game and get a sense of what the real math was. We just didn't have the programs to tell us the answers in such enormous detail until recently. But I agree with you. There are people whose brains, for whatever reason, seem more naturally tuned to the skill set that is demanded by poker players, or people who just pick it up faster. And then there are also people who have really strong work ethics, who come in not necessarily having those skills, but are willing to steadily work at them every single day. Whereas, don't get me wrong, there are still a number of poker players who just, you know, they make an okay living. Maybe they lose a little bit. Maybe they win a little bit. Maybe they get by, like, selling pieces to tournaments at high markups and then, you know, being a break-even player and making a little money that way. And they just don't study. It's still very common to have lots of people who just don't study or barely study at all. However, it's just a lot tougher to make a good living doing that. As to what I concentrate on, I'm still an MTT player. You're absolutely right that running exploitive play against weaker players in tournaments is likely an easier way to make a living at poker in this day and age than in cash. I'm not exactly the right person to speak on that because I haven't played serious online cash in a decade, you know, maybe longer or something like that. But I can say that during the quarantine, the tournaments online have grown in size and softness considerably. They've been fantastic. And I think that most people would say that for the moment, you know, it's a good window for the tournament players to be putting volume in and up against people who are playing for fun.
Yeah. So do you think that, you know, again, the TV that we all love to watch, right? The Poker After Dark, obviously, you know, the World Series of Poker, the main event. I mean, everyone has their favorite memories, their favorite champions. Like, I remember some of the best hands being when Joe Cotta won, and he just kept shipping it with lower pocket pairs and sucking out or just holding. Yeah, like, everyone has their own thing that they remember from back then. But the thing I most remember is just everyone was so aggressive, right? Just like 4 bets, 5 bets, 6 bets, pre-flop, all in and everything. And I in coming back to play during quarantine, mostly played cash games because that was what most of, like, the good content was. Like, I did the Run It Once course and have a couple buddies who are decent online card players, like, can play like 1-2 and 2-4 online. Is the online tournament play significantly different than it was then? Like, can you tell it's still more skilled, and can you tell if it's modeled in a different way, or is it still just like the people who are bad are still the people who are just being, like, way too aggressive?
You're right. There was a phase in poker, and maybe from like 2008 to 2012-ish, where everything was a pre-flop war. Like, if you saw those clips, I remember most distinctly there was a hand between Sean Deeb, I think his name was like Maximilian Heinz something, Larry, German guy. And he ends up six betting ace-six offsuit in the World Series main into Sean Deeb's aces and then sucking out on him. And to me, that was like the peak of the four-bet, five-bet, six-bet war phase in poker. Yeah. That has greatly diminished. That's really not what you see in tournaments anymore. It's mostly just like open raise call or open raise three-bet call. And a lot of the pre-flop battles have cooled down because partially solvers have taught us that we're not supposed to be putting in so many chips so frequently, and it gets very expensive if you continue that habit. I would say modern poker right now is a modern online tournaments, the thing that I'm qualified to talk on, is a really weird mix of these excellent players who have invested time working with solvers and have integrated theory into their game, and just like old school recreational players that are like bordering on the no set bet phase of poker. Like last night was the $10,000 World Series main online. They satellited a whole bunch of people in, and I was playing people on the table that, you know, weren't profitable in a $1 tournament. Like it was completely bananas. And so the range of skill levels right now is all over the place. And I think speaks to your game selection. You know, hopefully you're playing with the kind of people who are having a ball, playing for fun, couldn't beat that $1 tournament, and not just game selecting against the best in the world unless, you know, you're Ike Haxton.
Right. Yeah, or unless, you know, that's the only way you can get enough action to make it worth your time, basically. So we actually have kind of even glossed over to this point, but you are the voice of the World Poker Tour, which is a pretty fucking cool job. And I would imagine that you have a pretty good time doing it. But how did it come about? You know, Mike Sexton is, I think, very closely associated with many, many people as kind of the voice of poker. And, you know, replacing him, obviously, I don't think could be easy. But, you know, kind of how did the World Poker Tour gig come about?
I initially tried out for a segment on the show called The Raw Deal, where the idea was they wanted to bring in somebody who was preferably in the next generation of players who had a more technical viewpoint of the game than most commentators of that time, who could break down hands and wasn't afraid to be, you know, at time brutally honest with their assessment of how someone played or someone had acted at the table. I did that, plus our online streams and final tables, for about 7 years before Mike stepped down and took a chairman position at Party Poker, and I stepped up to fill his role in the booth with Vince Van Patten and Lynn Gill Martin as our anchor woman. And so it just kind of gradually built to that point where I was in the booth, but I was around the World Poker Tour, working at the World Poker Tour for almost a decade leading up to that. However, the whole like joining the corporate world, and then I'm still 10 years into it, and it still kind of screws with me. Like, it was so unplanned. It was so against what I was going for. It was so, like, left field that it still doesn't – it feels surreal to me sometimes. Like, I grew up, like, watching the World Poker Tour, watching Mike Vince. And then, like, I took the job audition as kind of like a laugh. Like, I was like, I'm going to go to a job audition and tell a dirty joke. This would be hilarious. You know, and instead they gave me the job and a career. And I was like, oh, whoa, I should probably make the most of this. But fortunately, I just – out there, man. It's a great place for me to be. I love how well working at the World Poker Tour and playing for a living complement each other. I really enjoy the people I work with and the casinos and properties that we run our events at. So I can't wait till we're running live events again. And I got to give a shout out, actually, because our big and our first WPT Online Poker Open event is coming up on the Party Poker US Network in the New Jersey player pool. That's December 27th through 29th. It's a $3,500 buy-in with $1 million guaranteed. And it's going to run over the course of the 27th through the 29th. So we're also committed to running huge events online as well. And my time with the WPT has been great, man. Actually, I'm headed to LA later today to get back in the booth with Vince and start producing episodes again after we had a hiatus following the pandemic.
Yeah, the return of live poker, I think many people are super looking forward to it. Kind of some good news on that front, obviously, with the return of the vaccines. One of the things I'm wondering is, you know, how much of this online poker stuff is going to translate into, you know, playing live tournaments, playing at casinos and stuff. I'm hoping that the answer is, like, you know, extremely high, because, you know, a lot of places do not have legal online poker, so people are playing on these offshore sites, which are,
yeah,
I mean, you know, they're fine, like, whatever. It's certainly not ideal. Like, if you were to choose, would I want to play on PokerStars in New Jersey or Pennsylvania or Party Poker or whatever, or do I want to play on sketchy offshore site X? Like, enough of us have had bad experiences with leaving money on online poker sites that, you know, it just doesn't feel great. But and also, I mean, you might not even know the answer to this question. Like, do you know if there is any good pending legislation stuff for online poker? Like, I don't even have a sense of if this is a wage, like, if this is a war that's being waged right now.
I'm not an expert on the subject, but I've been around it and talked about it for a long time. And here's my understanding of the legality of online poker in the United States. The subject of online poker has been relegated to a state's rights issue. It is something very unlikely to be decided or legislated on a federal level. So I think ever since Black Friday, a lot of poker players have always hoped for some day where, you know, Congress swoops in and decides online poker is legal across the land now. And I think that might be a near impossibility. I'm not going to call it an impossibility because we are evolving in our attitudes towards gambling in this country, and we are legalizing a lot of sports betting apps, and those companies are going to at times want to roll out tandem bills with sports betting and online poker. So I think there's a lot of hope for individual states to legalize online poker and then join in liquidity sharing agreements with other states, as we've seen between, say, New Jersey and Nevada so far. However, that is a really, like, slow process. Bureaucracy is slow. And then, like, you know, they legalize it, and then there's an even slower process for deciding if it's the license, and then another slow process for deciding if they're going to do liquidity sharing. And so I always feel bad because I'm like, I'm the black cloud in the room whenever people talk about legalizing online poker. I think anything like we grew up with a broadly global online player pool is a thing of the past. I think federal online poker is extremely unlikely, verging on impossible, but maybe. And I think state by state packs that gradually form, you know, pockets of player pool shared liquidity will happen slowly over time.
Yeah, I think you're almost definitely right. It just seems like even something that is basically legal in every state at this point, it's like 35 states, like weed. It's like we still don't have a federal mandate about the legality of, like, growing or possessing or transporting marijuana, and we probably won't ever. Like, literally, it'll probably be 2036. It'll be legal in every state but Kansas,
yep,
and we won't have a federal law. It'll all be down to the states, which obviously is, like, a terrible way to run things because, you know, people move in between states. Like, there are all sorts of uncontrollable circumstances.
Right.
And you get this in, for me, traveling state to state. It's like, there are some fantasy sports contests I can't do from Missouri. So I have to drive 15 minutes with my phone, go to Illinois, and I have to register for these contests, and then I drive back home, and I haven't broken any law. I haven't violated anything. It's literally just where my phone's GPS was that I have to do these. It's unbelievable. It's so stupid.
It's the operator who is trying to not circumvent the law, but prevent any laws from being broken.
Broken.
It's the operator that's trying to play by the rules. So because we have to do the same thing. If I want to play any daily fantasy sports, I have to drive 45 minutes to the state border of Prim, which I got to tell you, Davis, has saved me a lot of money this season.
I bet.
So I've made that drive like once.
Yeah, I mean, like, that actually, you live in, like, the epicenter of the hypocrisy, where, like, if I want to,
yeah,
like,
what the hell?
Like, if I want to go put my life savings down on one spin of the roulette wheel in the high credit room at the Wynn, I can do it. No questions asked. No one's going to stop me. But if I would like to play a $10 double up on DraftKings, I can't do it. I'm not allowed. It's so tilting to me. Yeah.
It's very tilting. And the simple answer as to why is who gets to take your life savings?
Yeah. And the casinos have, even though DraftKings and FanDuel are massive corporations, the casinos dwarf them. Absolutely dwarf them. Yeah. All right, the D-Nags Polk match. Have you been sweating it? Have you bet on it? And what do you think after watching thus far? What do you think, like, the true price of this wager is?
I have bet on it, and I have not watched a single hand. Basically, I did a decent amount of homework before the match trying to evaluate whether the 5-1 price was correct, and spoke to a lot of people, including, you know, like Mike McDonald, who's offering lines on this, to get his perspective, people who are betting on it. Came away thinking that Doug was probably, you know, an okay bet, but not a slam dunk one. And there was this big unknown variable. And how much work was Daniel Negreanu going to put into his heads-up game, and how good were the resources and coaches he was going to have? And the answer was clearly not good enough, because he's getting worked. And I don't mean just in terms of results. I think that, you know, most of the analysis I've seen from expert heads-up players is like, yo, this is a giant mismatch. You know, drawing dead is probably a little ambitious here. And I have seen some savvy people say, no, he's really turning it around. He's playing better each and every session. I don't know. But the sense I get from most people is that this was, you know, maybe closer to like a McGregor-Mayweather type matchup than two like excellent poker players. So I'm fortunate at least that I managed to sell the top of Negreanu. Like, he got out to an early lead and the price dropped on him, and I was like, now's when we buy. And that's when I got the money down. And pretty much like every day after that has just been like Doug hammering him. So I can't say that I've watched any. I don't know. I don't find heads up poker terribly interesting. It's not my game. You know, if I'm going to watch poker, I generally prefer it to be tournament poker because it's a little more applicable to what I do for a living. And so, yeah, as far as the match, it's done an excellent job of generating conversation and controversy and action, and viewership and all these things. But, you know, I got my money down and I'm happy, and I got stuff going on, so I can't say I've watched.
Okay, I got to come clean. I bet Daniel, and okay. I've made some dumb bets in my life. I have. This has got to rank as one of the dumbest. I did get it with a buddy who gave me better price than what was on Poker Shares. So I guess I can commend myself for getting a better price. But so this was my thinking. Basically, that Doug was maybe overrating his own talents relative to where the game had gone. And if Doug was 15% worse than when he was the best player in the world, and Daniel had access to the same solvers, effectively coaches who would maybe not be coaches who would not lose to Doug, right, you know, who would not beat Doug, but could at least understand what Doug was thinking and watch Doug play back with hand histories and everything and understand what Doug was trying to accomplish. My guess is probably that's what is happening, is that translating that knowledge from a coach to a student in poker is just too difficult if the student doesn't know how to think that way, right? Because I don't know if Daniel's brain is conditioned to think about the game in frequencies, right? I think it might be that simple.
He didn't grow up in the era super scientific poker. That's exactly right. But, you know, if you're feeling bad about that bet, I can tell you that a week ago, I bet on the Broncos without a quarterback against the Saints. And even though I got 17 points, that is probably the worst bet I'll make for years because, oh my God, what was I thinking? So, like, Davis, don't feel bad. Like, I honestly evaluated whether Negreanu was the bet prior to this. Like, I consider both sides. I don't think anybody who bet Negreanu should feel too bad about it. That's not a torch.
You're right.
That Broncos bet was a torch. I mean, Kendall Hinton, come on.
I believed in Kendall Hinton. I started Kendall Hinton in a high stakes fantasy football league. In the FFPC main event, we had a playoff game and we picked up Kendall Hinton because we're like, dude, he's starting at quarterback. We can play him at wide receiver. We get to have an extra quarterback that our opponent doesn't have. And he got negative points. We got negative points out of a wide receiver. But I honestly stand by it. With Daniel, I'm like, this was stupid and I should feel bad. And I bought out of this bet already because I was like, he's drawing. He can't win, I don't think. He's too far behind now. Because Doug could, if Daniel did start playing like miraculously overnight, like if he got amazing, Doug could start playing in a way to just like minimize big pots and like it would be so hard for him to lose, I think, at this point, especially because the stop loss is coming, I think, in like should be maybe even by the end of the week, where Daniel can opt out at 1,200, 5,000 hands.
And I assume he will. Like, there, you know, he's down almost $1 million or something. Like, stick around.
But what's $1 million to Daniel Negreanu, though, honestly?
And you know what? I think that might have been the number one compelling factor to evaluate going into this bet, which is, does Daniel have too much money, and what we call in poker, too much money syndrome, to really care and take this super seriously and like study his ass off and go back to work, you know, the way that somebody coming up in the game does. I really think that, you know, when you take a guy who has a lot of money and he doesn't need to win, and then you put him in a spot where it's going to take a ton of work in order to win a bet, bet against that guy. He just doesn't have to win. He just doesn't have to do it. He can afford to lose. Bet against those guys.
Yeah, I wonder how much money Bill Perkins would have to be feeding Daniel to, like, get – because Perkins has, seems like, way more money out on this match than Daniel does. And, you know, I'm sure Perkins is dangling some kind of carrot. Like, I saw – I wish I could give the credit to this. I saw someone tweeting, you know, what would Perkins have to offer Daniel to get him to keep going after 1,200, 5,000 hands? Because that's the only way Perkins can get unstuck, right, is if Daniel keeps playing, gets better – and gets back to even against Polk over the, you know, the second half of the bet. But what would, if Daniel wants to opt out, what carrot would Perkins have to dangle to get Daniel to keep playing? I mean, I don't know if there's an answer. He might just be done at that point, you know. It might not be possible.
That's hilarious to think about, man. I wish I was in Bill Perkins' betting circle.
Yeah. He loves to get the action out. Bill, if you're listening, we would also come on the show. We can talk about Die with Zero. We can talk about these bets. I would love to have Bill on the show. Anyone in poker, really, because these are my favorite episodes to do for sure.
Why are poker players your favorite episodes? I'm curious.
Because So I like know a lot of athletes and stuff anyways, right? Like just through work and through stuff. And so the shine of that, like, for example, if I was going to meet, Patrick Mahomes tomorrow, who's like my favorite athlete or whatever, it would be really cool. And I'd be like, wow, that's amazing. But I don't think I would be like as starstruck meeting him as I would be like getting on a Zoom call with Tom Dwan, who like I idolize, or I think these guys are really cool now as a grown-up, but like Phil Ivey and Tom Dwan and everyone, those guys were stars to me when I was 15 years old, which, you know, it's like a kind of an arrested development style thing where you have that that nostalgic effect where the shine will never leave that apple, basically. So poker to me is kind of like this cool nostalgic world where I'm not really a part of that I think is really cool. I don't know. But poker players are just, to me, like bigger stars than athletes, I guess, is kind of what it comes down to.
That's interesting. My guess would have been that athletes are often media trained and therefore are much more
guarded in
the type of answers they give, whereas poker players have been spent their entire careers answering to nobody to say whatever the hell they want. 100. Like, I'm the only poker player you're going to have on that's like running things through in his head before he says it out loud because like somebody might get mad at him. You know?
That's actually true. Yeah. Having like athletes and stuff like that on the show is like, they would be a little bit more guarded. There'd be some things they wouldn't want to talk about. Yeah. So the main event, you've cashed as high as 50th and won two bracelets. Do you have like a sick hand? You're like, oh, I put a disgusting beat on someone, or like I made the most ninth level soul read play of all time. Like I would assume the answer is yes, but maybe not. Maybe you just had the most normal bracelet win of all time and you just played tight, aggressive and got there.
I'm not going to do it to you, but I have a spectacular list of bad beats in the World Series main event. You know, for an event that I've only played like 15 times in my life, I've just got some amazing bad beats in that thing. As far as crazy sick hands that I played in order to capture the bracelets, you know what? It wasn't a crazy sick hand, but this summer I won my second bracelet online. And it was a six max event. And it wasn't like any one hand where it was just like, wow, you know, I really did some galaxy brain stuff that time. It was like, I got a chip lead deep-ish in that event. And then I just like put the pedal to the floor on the amount of pressure I applied to everyone else. And that was a spot where I was just kind of like proud of the work that I put in beforehand, then paying off. Because it used to be if I got a big chip lead in a tournament, I'd be like, sweet, okay, you know, like I gotta, you know, I can put a little pressure on, but I gotta sit in the lead. I don't want to blow it. Like there was still some sense of playing to not lose as opposed to playing to win. And I really felt like during that run, you know, I maximized my ability to play to win. And then when I got in a position to take advantage of having the most chips, I really put the screws into my opponents. And then three-handed, I just got very lucky in a hand that, you know, I'll always remember, because this guy raised and I ripped ace-nine into him and he plays king. And, you know, for just a lot of chips three-handed, it will probably yep. would have determined the bracelet. You know, I just drilled the guy with the biggest three-outer of my life. So that was very memorable. Good beat. There you go. There's a good beat
yeah.
story.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. that's a sick beat. Three-handed yeah. for a bracelet, and you put ace-nine down on a guy over ace-king. And that, like, that guy's told that story to his buddies yeah. 100 times. He's like, fucking ace-nine? Like, I can't believe it. Yeah. That's a sick beat to put down on someone.
Yeah, it definitely was. That one felt – I remember somebody asked me on Twitter after. It was like, wow, yeah, you know, congrats on the win, but how does it feel to rob somebody of a bracelet with the brutal three-outer with that ace-nine? I was like, how does it feel? Amazing. Like,
feels great, yeah.
The guy that did it, you know.
Exactly. Like, why would I be mad about it? Like, this is a beautiful thing that happened to me. And I mean, mm-hmm. just like the – it's true. You got to run so good to win a poker tournament. Like, you have to play well, yes. and you've got to run, like, I mean, depending on the size of the field. Like, to win the main event, you have to play super well, and you have to run literally 99th percentile, like the hottest of your life, over 6 days. Like, it's just the nature of the game. You got to run good.
Exactly right. Yeah, you really, and yeah, just, and not only that, nothing big can go wrong. You have to run great, and nothing big can go wrong. Like, it's just everything just has to fall into place. And those rare moments when you do actually capture a win, it's just a sweet feeling. Everyone reacts a little bit differently. I always find my emotional state following a big win is relief. Like, I've spent my whole life playing tournaments and then have them turning out awful in the end, or, you know, I'm the guy who takes the three outer, or, you know, I just lost the flip or ran out of chips, whatever it is. It always doesn't really end your way. And then when it all falls perfectly into place and you're the guy that runs good and drills everybody, I'm just like so relieved. I'm like, wow, nothing bad happened. I can't believe it.
Yeah. What is the experience of playing the main event? Like, obviously that's like a bucket list goal for, mm-hmm. for lots of people. Have you played it enough times that like the shine is worn off? I kind of imagine it kind of having like a summer camp vibe, or like maybe actually the World Series of Poker for poker players is like coming back from summer break, and you're like seeing everyone's new haircuts, and like you know, it's the reunion for lots of people who only see each other once a year.
The World Series in the summer is very much a grown-up summer camp kind of yeah. vibe. Like you said, it's catching up with a lot of people that you may only see once or twice a year. You know, often you try and mix in drinks, dinner, whatever it is, in the after hours with these people that you want to catch up with. The main event itself, I've played every year since I was 21, and I'm 36 now, so 15 times. And the novelty doesn't really wear off because there are no other events quite like it. Like, there's no other events in the world where just a bunch of just like random people who like poker but don't play seriously at all, don't study poker, don't invest serious time into it, find $10,000 to come and play with us. Like, that's a lot of money in the real world. That's a I know in poker we get very numb and desensitized to the figures that we talk about. Oh, I made, you know, 5K bet on this, and I won 20K on that, and then I cashed a tournament for 43K or whatever. It just starts to become something we use to describe our job. But $10,000 in the real world is a ton of money, and for the most part, everyday citizens don't just grab $10,000 and plunk it down in a huge tournament with almost no chance of winning, except for that one time per year. So it's a very special event for that reason, just the volume of people it brings in, the novelty for them. And then as a professional poker player, it's one of your best opportunities to make money for the year. It's super exciting, and it's the time of the year when the people around you will take the most interest in your profession. So yeah. like, you know, if I go deep in some big tournament during the year, if I go deep in a WPT or the Aussie Millions or something like that, you know, I'll get some texts from friends and family, you know, maybe my social media picks up a little bit. But if you go deep in like the World Series main event, like people you haven't thought of from high school 15 years ago will like track you down and be like, oh, wow, I saw you in chips on day three, go, you know, like you'll get all kinds of crazy messages. So the amount of interest around that event is very unique as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I would love to get out there. It does sound like an incredible thing, and certainly, I hope the return to live poker happens. sooner rather than later. So Tony, what do we have to look forward to with the World Poker Tour? How can we support? How can we find more of your excellent content? What do we have to show?
Well, as I said, on the WPT, the WPT Online Poker Open main event is coming up December 27th through 29th on the Party Poker US Network. That is New Jersey only, but anybody within New Jersey is eligible to play. So if you're in the state or nearby, we'd love to see you on there. It is $1 million guaranteed and $3,500 buy-in that runs over the course of 3 days with a live stream final table. I create content for Learn WPT, myself, and some other fantastic players. My guy, Andrew Lucky Chewy Lichtenberger, Vanessa Seltz, Nick Binger, they've all been performing really strong in the tables lately, and we're super committed to the content we do there. The World Poker Tour still airs on Fox Sportsnet on Sunday nights, and as I said, I'm about to get back in the booth tomorrow with Vince. So, you know, new final tables, new content is coming. It's along the way, and I want, you know, we actually have a live event coming up at Seminole Hard Rock in January as to when the full swing of the live tour is back. I don't want to speculate too specifically because I don't have inside information and I don't want to promise anything that won't be there. But with the promise of the vaccine and the timetable we're hearing about it being rolled out in March and April, I personally like to think that we see a lot of major live tournaments throughout the globe and in the United States back in swing in the second half of 2021.
There we go. I very much hope for more good news on that front. Everyone, follow Tony on Twitter, watch the World Poker Tour, and we will be back next week.
Build digital-first customer relationships with Salesforce Digital 360. Connect every marketing, commerce, and digital experience on a single platform. Innovate fast with easy-to-launch sites, campaigns, and apps. That's more relationships, more revenue, more return, and more success. Salesforce Digital 360. Hear from our customers at sfdc.co/digital360.